I'm Shannon and I live in New Zealand. I've been living here for about 9 years now. I am not from New Zealand originally. I'm actually from Iowa once upon a time. And here in New Zealand, I am a theater reviewer, critic, director, and vocal coach because New Zealand theater is very small. And so if you want to scratch out a living in it, you've got to be able to do a couple of different things.
But you can scratch out a living in it.
But you can scratch out a living in it.
Have you ever played a hobbit or an orc?
I have not, but I have a lot of friends and coworkers who have.
Awesome. What a cool group to hang out with. You've been listening to the podcast since the beginning, you said, and we met just now, in fact, because you sent me a letter. You know, I ask people to send me feedback every week on the podcast, and rarely do they. And so I guess what we're learning now is if you send me some feedback, you can be on a podcast.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or tablet or phone. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 503, Too Much Parody? In episode 491, Reviewing the Reviews, we mentioned a critic who, in a favorable review of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, questioned the value of parody in the commercial theater. Podcast listener Shannon Friday thought we gave insufficient time to discussing that point, so she sent me an email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com asking if we could talk more about it. So I Skyped her. In an extremely wide-ranging conversation, Shannon and I talked about parody, its limits, and its power, and also about the nature of reviews and criticism.
What was interesting to me about that podcast is, as a reviewer, sometimes there's this tension between, are you just reviewing the show that you're looking at and trying to give this like newspaper, here's what happens and here's my experience of it? Or do you need to offer some criticism as well? Is there a trend that you're noticing? And the tension between that then brings up this really kind of huge question of what is a reviewer's responsibility? And that brings up another really kind of huge question of like, how are reviews helpful to theater companies? Because I do think as a reviewer, I've got a responsibility to you guys because you guys are giving me the tickets to come and see the shows.
Right. Well, I guess I would ask you, first of all, when you're writing a review, who are you writing it for?
I would say I have the luxury, given the publications I write for, we know we have the statistics and a huge percentage of our audience for each of those publications either works in arts or is an arts funder or sponsor. So I can talk pretty directly to that community. There aren't heaps of casual readers coming to the site going, "Oh, I want to check that out."
So you're right. You're right. So your audience is mostly fellow practitioners and artists.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, that's cool because I think there are plenty of critics, and I would argue maybe most critics feel like they're not writing to the artists. They're writing to audience members, ticket buyers.
Mm-hmm. And it's a really unusual position to be in to go, oh, yeah, I can totally just write for the people who are making this and go, here's what I think. And it's almost like freelance dramaturg sometimes.
Yeah, no, it's just true. Well, and a freelance dramaturg as a critic is maybe not a bad thing. I mean, I think there's a difference. There are differences between reviews and criticism, reviewing a show and criticizing the show. And I would say a review, speaking broadly, a review is a kind of a buyer's guide. You know, you're saying, is this show worth whatever you're going to pay for the ticket money and your 2 hours or 3 hours of time? And many of those are written quickly and under deadline pressures.
Very quickly, yeah.
And so they're at best an overview. And criticism, I think, is more thoughtful, more composed, I think wants to examine the piece in the context of other pieces like it, or in the context of other theater like it, or in context of the time it's being produced, blah, blah, blah. You know, to give it slightly more of a contextual analysis, which and both of those can be helpful or not helpful. We find, as Reed and I think agree about the Reed Martin, my co-author and co-owner of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, Reed and I find that we're the owners of the company, so for us, we need to know what people are saying about our productions. So we know, is this something we need to address in our marketing, or really that's kind of true for us as playwrights as well. You know, sometimes if several critics say, "Boy, it felt long here," or they'll say, "It felt long," we'll go, "Okay, mm-hmm. enough people have said that where it probably is long," and we know that we want it to clip along, but you know, sometimes it's good to get that confirmation. You know, I hear from artists and directors that they don't read the reviews, and I don't believe them. And if they don't,
I don't believe them either.
Yeah,
some of the Facebook messages.
And if they don't, and if they are able to avoid reviews, it's because they have people on their staff who read the reviews for them and give them the overview of the review. So it's not as if they ignore reviews and are blithely and artistically above the reviews. Everybody reads the reviews, and I think any artist needs to know how the art is being received and talked about. We've actually been told by a marketing director for a theater in a major metropolitan area that his theater critic told him, "You don't want me reviewing a Reduced Shakespeare Company show." You know, the implication being, he will hate it, he will write a review that's terrible. So mm-hmm. I'm like, well, okay, nice to know that you don't have an open mind. At least you're aware that you don't have an open mind about
it. And I would say, yeah, I would say he or she is doing their professional duty as a reviewer by saying, "No, this one's not for me, and I don't think I can look at it fairly," because sometimes you can't, and sometimes there are shows that come up, and you're just like, "Nope." Mm-mm.
And I think that's great. And I think, you know, because to pretend that one doesn't have a bias is ridiculous. To pretend there's such a thing as pure objectivity is ridiculous.
Yeah, and I think for everyone writing as a critic or as a reviewer, and I do distinguish between those two jobs, and think that reviewing needs to have some criticism in it, not in the form of like here being critical, being mean, or telling you what to fix, because that's not my job.
Right.
Another weird thing as a reviewer, where often I'm trying to judge a show according to what it wants. Like certain shows ask different things of you as an audience member.
Right.
A show that a late night improv, that short form improv show, which I do review, I'm going to review very differently from an award-winning drama down from the States that lasts for 3 hours and has a slow burn. Like right. One of them asks me to engage totally differently as an audience member and trust there's going to be a long payoff.
Right.
The other kind of has a duty to keep me ticking over every minute.
Yeah.
And so there's this thing that I think for the first 2 years I was reviewing, I was punishing ambitious shows. By going, "Oh, you guys are really trying to do something, and guess what? You got like 70% there." which, as someone who works in theater, just about everything you make gets 70% there.
Like, right. I think that's good that the reviews come in the context of what the event is, because mm-hmm. every event is different. Even if you go to say one theater that does one kind of a show, and then the next show, it's a completely different kind of show. That's a different kind. Except it might take place in the same space, and being in that space creates an expectation that mm-hmm. I mean, we're conscious of the fact that people come to see Reduced Shakespeare Company shows if they know us with a certain kind of expectation, and we want to be able to successfully deliver on that expectation. And at the same time, deliver on that expectation in a way that surprises the people who've seen our shows before. Mm-hmm. So they're not just expecting the same kind of thing. The thing that you mentioned in your email and just a minute ago about that one review, it was talking about the value of, is parody a useful genre, or do we really need to be watching parody anymore. And I think my reaction on the podcast to that, well, to that, I only have to say this. And you were hoping for a more sophisticated response than a raspberry, which I will try to give. One is that I think that's a very interesting conversation, and I think it's longer than what we were doing for reviewing the reviews. But mm-hmm. I'm also not. I take issue with the idea that our shows are parodies. I think they're satirical. And I think they have, elements of parody in them, but I wouldn't describe every show, I'm not sure any of our shows as out-and-out parodies. I think of a parody as, Mad Magazine taking the current hip movie and writing a completely skewed version of that movie to make fun of that movie. That's a parody of that. I think of the songs of Weird Al Yankovic that take popular songs and rewrite the lyrics, but perform them in a really top-notch professional way.
Whereas I think of Galaxy Quest as being a parody of Star Trek, but also being its own thing.
Yes, well, and I think the best parodies are their own things. And I think mm-hmm. that when a parody becomes its own thing, I think it then crosses over into satire. You know, mm-hmm. because I would agree with you about Galaxy Quest, and I would say Spinal Tap is similar because it is a parody of that genre of music, and maybe a parody of these kinds of rock documentaries, but it's its own thing that you begin to care about. And I guess I would say in the context of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play, Abridged, I think it's certainly a satire of Shakespeare, and I think there are places where we are parodying certain lines, but by and large, I think we are trying to create not just a parody, but the thing itself. Mm-hmm. In the same way that Orson Welles created Chimes at Midnight by taking all the lines and scenes and dialogue about Sir John Falstaff and making a single narrative, or in the way that currently at Chicago Shakespeare Company here in Chicago, Barbara Gaines has taken many scenes from all the 8 or 10 history plays to focus on it's called Tug of War, and it focuses mm-hmm. on the non-landed, non-royal, non-titled people who actually fight in all the wars that the kings begin.
Cool.
And I hope that Shakespeare's long lost first play is in the spirit of those plays, in that we've taken Shakespeare to create a new thing that is authentically Shakespeare and also a conversation with Shakespeare and a conversation about Shakespeare. So I guess you wouldn't call Chimes at Midnight a parody. And so I guess in a certain sense, I wouldn't call Long Lost Shakes a parody. Does that make sense?
And I kind of wish I could talk to that critic now and go find out what their definition of parody is. Because is it like a cultural riff that is also funny? Is that their definition of parody?
Right. And if it's funny, that means it's less.
Mm.
There is that. I think there's a snobbery about comedy. I'm laughing, so therefore it must not be important. To which I say...
Hello, as far as I know, I'm Weird Al Yankovic, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This week, we begin performing William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged at the Pleasance Courtyard at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. We'll be here from August 3rd to the 29th, and then we return to the U.S. this fall to perform the special election edition of The Complete History of America Abridged in more than 17 states, including Missouri, Iowa, Montana, Indiana, Minnesota, Utah, Michigan, Kentucky, Alaska, Washington, New Jersey, Ohio, Virginia, South Carolina, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Florida. All those dates are up on our website now. We'll also be touring for 3 weeks in China, and in 2017, we'll begin a UK tour of William Shakespeare's long-lost first play Abridged. We'll have more information about those overseas tours later this fall. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information.
The other thing that I love about good parody and good satire is that, as we were saying, it's funny and it's making fun of the thing, but it's also its own thing, and you sit there engaged with it as its own thing, but you by making fun of it, you're also looking at it from a different way. So you have two things going on. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why some people get scared of parody or scared of comedy, because, wait, you're making me have a nuanced reaction to things by making me embrace it seriously and honestly and also laugh at it. That mm-hmm. That is blowing my mind, and I'm uncomfortable with that.
It's kind of like a para spoiler, like when you find out something about a piece of media and you're going, oh, this changes how I view it leading up to.
Right.
Is a parody going to then change the way that you go back and revisit the thing that it's parodying? Sometimes folks can be really, I think sometimes part of the discussion we're having about parody is people wanting to hang on to that initial experience of what they've got mm-hmm. and not wanting to kind of look at it out of the corner of their eye and go, oh my gosh, there's actually a really interesting angle over here. But
right.
No, I've been looking at this thing head on, and it is my favorite thing ever.
Yes, yes.
Get some very protective people that way.
No, it's true. It's true. Hopefully, in the context of this story about Puck and Ariel and their ancient grudge and merry war, we are also saying something about Shakespeare's playwriting tropes, and we're saying mm-hmm. something about our relationship to Shakespeare, and we're saying something about Shakespeare's use of magic as metaphor, and I think all of that, and we're also talking about Shakespeare as a showman, and comparing him to, you know, Walt Disney. And the Disney Company's arguably the greatest showman of our day, you know. So mm-hmm. anyway, there's a lot going on, but it's also just a play about two fairies trying to one-up each other. And it's a play about three idiots trying to reduce a massive manuscript.
I still keep going back to that original parody comment about is there too much right now? Because that seems like, going back and reading historical criticism, that's a question that seems to come up about once a generation.
We might be having that moment now, because Chris Jones, the critic for the Chicago Tribune, just wrote something similar about are we having a moment about parody, and is there too much of a good thing? He said it in the context, there's a play going on, I'm going to see it tonight, in fact, at a theater here in Chicago called Death of a Streetcar Named Virginia Woolf, colon, a parody. So that's part of...
Glad they made that clear.
Yeah, exactly right. It's a stupid title. It's such a stupid title, and I don't know... But it smacks of anti-comedy intellectualism, first of all, in my view. Oh, really? Nobody could get that it's a parody, you nitwits? On the other hand, giving them the benefit of the doubt, it might be the sort of thing to ward off the lawyers for the estates of Arthur Miller and Tennessee Williams. Say, hey, this is a parody. It's copyright. Blah, blah, blah.
Fair use applies here, guys.
Fair use applies, which doesn't mean they won't come after you. But anyway, so Chris Jones was writing in the context of that about some other parody shows that are coming up. There's one called Disenchanted. It's a musical about all of the Disney princesses, but they're not called Disney princesses. They're all the princesses from the Grimm's fairy tales, which are in their public domain, and they sing songs that are like Disney, but not Disney. So mm-hmm. they're skirting that issue. And there's a show that's coming to Chicago called The Barty Bunch. So it's The Brady Bunch, but with Shakespearean text or something. I'm not 100% sure what it is.
Go ahead. So this thing that you guys have been doing since 1981, all of a sudden you find yourselves among a lot of other people doing something similar. I'm not going to say the same, but similar.
Right.
And all of a sudden you guys become the focal point for that larger criticism.
Well, yes, at the Folger. Fortunately, Chris Jones, who has reviewed us before, did not mention us in this article that he wrote. It's interesting because I think of in the complete works of William Shakespeare, there's Rap Othello, classic bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't write it, so I can say it's a classic bit. But it is clearly a satire of political correctness, where three white guys are appropriating African American culture to appropriate a Shakespearean play and play an African American character without doing blackface. And also, it's a 30-year-old idea that supposes that that white guys can't rap, which that's no longer, I think, a current thing. Mm-mm. But nonetheless, it's both a parody and a satire. Now, I think I've heard Lin-Manuel Miranda say this. He didn't want Hamilton to be a parody of rap or hip-hop.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted it to be the thing itself. And in fact, reading the book about the show, never, ever, anywhere does anybody involved with Hamilton describe it as a rap musical or a hip-hop musical. It's a musical.
It's a musical.
It uses the vocabulary of rap and hip hop as its in the same way you wouldn't call any of Richard Rodgers' musicals a waltz musical, even though mm-hmm. Richard Rodgers likes to write in 3/4 time, you know. So and it's totally legit and totally smart, and it uses the vocabulary of rap and hip hop to tell this story, and I think that's what we're doing with Long Lost First Play, is that we're using the vocabulary of Shakespeare in over 60 or 70% of the time, his actual vocabulary, to tell this new story. We've covered a lot of ground. Have I answered your questions?
I guess the only one that I would have is, like, and this might be asking you guys to show the trick a little bit, and the trick is always ugly. Is there a review that you've had or a comment that you've had, aside from it feels too long, where it's kind of made you sit back and think and go, no, we hadn't considered this before. And then, like, what changes does that mean for you guys as makers?
I off the top of my head, I can't think of one. I don't think we've had that kind of review, because I think We haven't had that kind of review from a critic, because I think in the past we've had that kind of an observation or note or criticism from one of our inner circle, be it a wife or a kid or an actor, who said, wait a second, this seems totally weird. Why this? And that forces us to either explain it better or come up with a different notion. I would say
so you test it before it gets to the audience and find those things early.
Absolutely. We have an inner circle. That's part of the development process. Sometimes we'll hear a review and we'll go, yeah, that's fair. And other times we'll hear a review and we'll talk about it, and then we'll either fix it or we'll go, he's wrong.
And you do, as a critic, you do sometimes just get it wrong. And it can be really hard to know where to admit that without, if all you have is a medium for reaching your audience, it can be really hard to go, oh, I got this review for this show wrong. In a review for another show, no, that's not fair to either show.
No, I know.
Yeah,
and it would be fun if critics came out and re-reviewed things or reconsidered. And I've seen that happen a couple times, but there's so much going on, typically you can barely write the reviews of the shows you want to write about, let alone re-review the shows.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your thoughts and questions and requests for further elaboration via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You might get a podcast out of it. You can also engage with us and other fans on Facebook or Twitter. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, unprofessional parodist Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Joe McConville. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to professional parodist Weird Al Yankovic. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 503 1509ths of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
Well, cool, Shannon. Thank you very much for sending me the email and getting up so gosh darn early to talk with me.
No worries.
Give my love to the Kiwis.
Will do.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.